Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And we have a little bit of a problem because I've got Paul here, and he's ready to dive into, because I just told him, we're going to be doing the notes on James Madison's notes on the nullification of 1834. And actually, I completely forgot that sequentially we need to cover James Madison's letter to John George Jackson. And so if you go ahead, because I know you got all of these files, you want to look up the file titled James Madison's Letter to J.G. Jackson, 1821. And while you're doing that, Paul,
I found it.
The reason, and I've mentioned this before, that, you know, John, who was, I think, a relative on Dolly Madison's side, somehow there was some relation, because at the very last part of this letter, you can kind of see a little bit of an intimate relationship. Hey, give the family, you know, our hugs or whatever. Because I'm going to read the whole thing. We're going to read this whole thing. But the reason why this is important is because John G. Jackson, as well as other, I'll say, citizens or patriots, were becoming alarmed with the government and its powers it was executing. Now, remember, this is at the end of 1821. And so you have to look at what was actually happening and some of the rulings from the courts, because I think I gave you that long list of, and correct me if I'm wrong, I gave you the Marbury v. Madison case that was in 1803, yeah. Right? So let me jump to really when it started happening. Okay. Fletcher v. Peck was in 1810, and then Sturgis v. Crownshield, 1819. Then Dartmouth College versus Woodward in 1819. McCulloch v. Maryland in 1819. And then Cohens v. Virginia in 1821.
Well, there was one more you gave me, Gibbons versus Ogden in 1824.
Yeah. That was after. This letter is in response to what they're seeing the court saying, because you got to remember that Madison never challenged the actual verdicts of the case, but he didn't necessarily agree with the opinions, but they were just opinions. Right?
Okay.
I mean, when you hear, you know, somebody blathering away and they make themselves feel better, you know, they're saying something. I mean, you know, if it's just opinion, do you want to call the person out? When they accurately, you know, made the proper judgment in the case that Maryland cannot tax the federal government in Maryland v. McCulloch. And so in each of these cases, Marshall was correct, but he took latitude and made wrong assertions, literally unconstitutional assertions, that, you know, they could do these things.
And which, and the court then, looking at these opinions, began to base law on opinion.
Well, not the court, the lawyers who began liquefying the foundation of our government. When I say liquefying, you know, this Constitution's granite. Mm-hmm. And the only way it could be changed or redefined is if the parties choose to change it or redefine it.
Right.
When they say this is what this means, then that's it. It's all final. Or when it was initially created, and the federal government, I'll give you a case in point. In 1790, Congress defined a natural-born citizen. The states did not have any objections to that. That was the hard definition. So, because Congress needed to define what that meant.
Mm-hmm.
And the states go, yep, that's good enough. We accept that.
Okay.
Now, when the courts actually looked and they've redefined that, the states have pushed back and said, hey, hold on. That's not what they said back then. And the courts say, well,
did the states push back?
So I believe that there have been, like, I'll give you a good case in point. Because we're looking at today where we've actually had Obama unconstitutionally serve because he was not eligible to serve in the presidency. We have Kamala Harris serving when she is ineligible to be in the executive office. And now we have Nikki Haley and Vivek Ramaswamy who are not eligible based on that definition of a natural born citizen. And so either they've redefined it or they've just turned their back on it completely. Mm-hmm. But I'll give you a case in point where when you look at the rights of the U.S. citizens are preserved by the Constitution, there's nowhere in the Constitution that extends the rights of U.S. citizens to all citizens or all people of the world.
Right.
So when a person comes to the United States and are subject to the jurisdiction of a foreign nation, they do not have the rights of a citizen extended to them. Mm-hmm. The only way the right of a citizen can be extended is they have to become a citizen. Even when they're a green card and they, you know, and they haven't naturalized yet, they do not have the right to vote. They do not have the right to own property. All of these things are to be constrained from them mm-hmm. until they become a citizen. And so this was defined in the early days of 1790, 1792, and I think there was like two or three more acts. And this was the defining of the citizens. And I can look the acts up, but this is where they basically laid out, because you have to understand that at the time the United States was acquiring property, there were people living on that property that may have been subjects to foreign nations. And so they were considered inhabitants, but they did not carry the rights of a citizen. Now, they may have actually had property. And so they respected the property of inhabitants who already possessed property. But that didn't mean a foreigner could come in and possess property. And so over time, you know, as those people died off and those people that were born here, unless they were naturalized, they never really became citizens unless they were naturalized. But you have to remember that for 20 years, because of the slavery issue, they allowed the states to maintain this whole, you know, importation of people.
Correct.
For slaves and so forth. That meant that the states had carte blanche control over the importation of people. But the federal government created the standard because they had to normalize or create a uniform law of naturalization. So here is the requirement to become a citizen to obtain rights of property rights, all rights that a citizen is protected with. If you're not a citizen, you really, even though you may be an inhabitant and you possess land, that does not mean that that land can't be taken from you.
Interesting.
Only a U.S. citizen has those rights, like the Fifth Amendment, that if, you know, if eminent domain steps in and the government takes your land for public use, not private use, but for public use, then they have to give you just compensation. But an inhabitant is not guaranteed that, nor does the state need to actually compensate.
That's interesting.
It is interesting. And so, you know, here's the other thing. Powers not delegated to the states are powers not delegated to the federal government are reserved to the states. Unfortunately, the state constitution doesn't say that powers not delegated to the state are reserved to the counties, though the state constitutions actually have the enumerated powers. And so is the power of property and the rights of property controlled by the states, or is it controlled by the, if it's not delegated, then technically it's not controlled by neither the state nor the county.
You know, I'm having a,
I know this. This is why I decided to dive into this a little bit to kind of placate that discussion. Because if our constitutions are specified powers of attorney, then what is articulated in the Constitution to the state and what is articulated to in the Constitution to the federal government, if nowhere it's delineated on the rights of property, such as mineral rights, then the power has not been given and it is retained by the people who own their property. Now, the question is, does the state have the power to, you know, tax property? Well, you have to look at the taxing powers. Does the state have the authority delegated to it to actually commit direct taxation? So you have to really examine the Constitution. Anybody that just frivolously, you know, says that I just don't see something doesn't mean that something else wasn't granted. Right. Mm-hmm. So you have to look at the Constitution to determine what powers of taxation were delegated. If the state actually has direct taxation, then they can tax property.
Well, sure. And it's important to read, you know, we can read the U.S. Constitution typically in one sitting. It's got 5,000 words. But state constitutions, some of them are long. I mean, I learned just recently the about Alabama Constitution, about three times the size of the Missouri Constitution. And it's a few hundred pages.
And the Iowa Constitution is maybe 60. I think. I mean, I looked at it and go, wow, that's kind of a short, to-the-point Constitution. Anyway, right. So these men, and, you know, asked John G. Jackson to be the, you know, the speaker of them. And so he requested, because he knew Madison was sitting on these notes of the Constitutional Convention, and he hadn't published them yet. As he took notes as what was being argued and so forth, and if anybody's read these Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention, they're very insightful of what was being said. And so, I mean, it was Madison's notes that helped us understand Mason's point of, you know, how he viewed slavery and how, you know, the whole issue of slavery was being, you know, how it evolved through that Constitutional Convention. And so John G. Jackson went, you know, and said, hey, would you please, you know, release those notes? At least give us a copy, something. You know, and that would have been a monumental task to actually sit down and make copies of that notes, of those notes. You know, in other words, it would take a lot of labor because, you know, they didn't have Xerox, right? They didn't have the ability to take pictures and all of that. So let's go ahead and dive into this letter. Again, this is December, the end of December, 1821. And as a matter of fact, it points out that this is from Montpelier. So in other words, he was in his home and he sat down and wrote this letter.
Okay. James Madison, George Jackson, John George Jackson, December 27, 1821, Montpelier. With respect to that portion of the mass which contains the voluminous proceedings of the convention, it has always been my intention that they should some day or other see the light. But I've always felt, at the same time, the delicacy attending such a use of them, especially at an early season. In general, I have leaned to the expediency of letting the publication be a posthumous one. The result of my latest reflections on the subject I cannot more conveniently explain than by the enclosed extract from a letter one, confidentially written since the appearance of the proceedings of the convention as taken from the notes of Chief Justice Yates. Of this work, I have not yet seen a copy. From the scraps thrown into the newspapers, I cannot doubt that the prejudices of the author guided his pen, and that he has committed egregious errors, at least in relation to others as well as to myself.
So right there, he's pointing out that Yeats was saying things that Madison didn't agree with, and that his notes proved otherwise. Go ahead.
Okay.
Okay.
And all right. That most of us carried into the convention a profound impression produced by the experienced inadequacy of the old Confederation.
Okay. Clearly, he emphasized that the Confederation was completely inadequate, that the necessity of this convention was paramount. Keep going.
And that the monitory examples of all similar ones, let me stop here. He's using the term monitory, and I don't think he's referring to money.
So monitoring, monitory.
Okay, monitory. Okay, I wasn't familiar with the word. I'll start over again. And by the monitory examples of all similar ones, ancient and modern, as to the necessity of binding the states together by a strong constitution is certain. The necessity of such a constitution was enforced by the gross and disreputable inequalities which had been prominent in the internal administrations of most of the states. Nor was the recent and alarming insurrection headed by Shays in Massachusetts without a very sensible effect on the public mind. Such indeed was the aspect of things that in the eyes of all the best friends of liberty, a crisis has arrived, which was to decide the American experiment was to be blessed to the world. Is that what that?
Yes, think that's correct. That, okay. Yeah. So again, he's abbreviating. Yes. American. Yes.
Okay. American experiment was to be a blessing to the world, or to blast forever the hopes which the Republican cause had inspired, and what is not to be overlooked.
Okay, so can I get you to hold up real quick?
Because this
kind of speaks to what I've been saying. This American experiment was a putting away of the monarchical mind model, or the model of governing, of this Republican government, a true. Because even in Rome, the Caesar held all the power. Even though the Senate may have had power, the Caesar still was a dictator. And even though the Senate may have had all that power, it was a centralized body, and the states didn't possess any power. The Senate could actually inflict bad things and harm the states. Never has there ever been a governing body that empowered the people and the people's local government over the government above them and over the government above them. There's never been this complex level of republicanism. This goes to why they kept on bringing up Montesquieu's book on republics and saying republics need to be small. Well, they are within this paradigm, because the smallest republic that rules, or where we actually rule ourselves, is the county.
Mm-hmm.
And then we create an overseeing general government to provide services and protection for those instituted governments within that state, those counties, which is why the states created a general government. So in other words, we have two layers of confederacy. And so with two layers of confederacy, that to me becomes, you know, such a brilliant, such an ingenious way of creating protections from tyranny.
Right.
Okay. All right. Okay. So go ahead.
And what is not to be overlooked, the disposition to give a new system all the vigor consistent with Republican principles was not a little stimulated by a backwardness in some quarters towards a convention for the purpose, which was ascribed to a secret dislike to popular government and a hope that delay would bring it more into disgrace and pave the way for a form of government more congenial with monarchical or aristocratical predilections.
Okay.
What is he talking about?
So he's now talking about these big government people that they had to unseat once they unleashed the Constitution. Because basically he said that was not, okay, so I'm going to go to the beginning. What is not to be overlooked, the disposition to give to a new system all the vigor consistent with the Republican principles was not a little stimulated by backwardness in some quarters. In other words, some people still wanted to have this monarchy towards a convention for the purpose. So in other words, there was this desire to move back to a permanent president. Who was it that actually proposed that the president be permanent? It was Hamilton. Okay. Which was ascribed to a secret dislike to popular government and a hope, this is why this is kind of underlined, and a hope that delay would bring it more into disgrace and pave the way for a form of government more congenial, in other words, more like a monarchical or aristocratical predilections. In other words, these guys wanted to move that way, and they started doing that.
So he's referring to a secret dislike. Somehow he probably was privy to it, and maybe this was coming from Madison?
Well, so the secret dislike was coming from Hamilton and those
big... I meant Hamilton.
Yes, Hamilton and those people who wanted to have a government like England. So do you see the quandary? Because they didn't sever and renew everything. I mean, they were still clinging to Blackstone's, commentary on the law. When that was designed and, it was conforming to the British monarchy and that common law as it operated. Technically, they should have actually said, that's nice, we need to build off of that, and we need to place, create our own commentary based on a constitutional Republican form of government that we have today. And we should have severed this relationship, or, is referring to these documents that kept on taking us back into this monarchical view, which is why the Jural assemblies are using the monarchical view that they had these powers. Or, I'll call them the doctrine of the lesser magistrates. All of these things are based upon the monarchical form of government. And Madison is clearly saying that that was a secret design that these guys were trying to take us back there. And they're still doing this. Anna von Ritz is doing this. All of these different people of the sovereign societies is trying to get us back. And believe it or not, I was reading an interesting article that basically has tied Anna von Ritz to the British crown.
Really?
Yes. And this is very insightful because when I read some of the stuff that she says, I'm going, this is not based on our Republican form of government that was created. So,
send that to me.
So, yeah, I will. The bottom line is this, is that there was a struggle out the gate with this Constitution. And actually, there were two struggles. There was the struggle of the cabal of the states, because the states didn't want to give up these powers. They wanted to have their own little monarchies. And, as they said, okay, now that we've conformed this, well, now we who like monarchies need to invoke or go back to, and that's exactly what Adams was trying to do. We're going to go into a break right now, but when we come back, we'll pick it up from where Adams was, trying to protect and creating laws to suppress any of the opposing views with the 1798 resolutions. But it's really clear that there was a very clear and present resistance during the early days of the Constitution. We'll be right back, folks.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416. Okay, so when Adams was creating, or actually when Congress created and Adams passed this, this was the Federalist, and this is where the secret society really took a hold, if you want to call it a secret society. Here's a bunch of people that, you know, took an oath to support the Constitution, and then they deliberately started passing laws that would actually empower them and violate the Constitution, suppressing speech and so forth. And so the struggle was real, but most people completely, you know, because it just seemed like America self-corrected, and that's not the case. What ended up happening was Madison and Jefferson actually executed a coup, but even then they didn't get rid of this monarchical secret society that was existing. The Federalists ended up becoming obsolete with James Monroe becoming president. Now, let me ask you this.
Wait. The Federalists became obsolete with James Monroe becoming president?
It was perceived, yes, because there was no Federalist. There was nobody that ran for president against him in his second term.
So the Anti-Federalists became obsolete.
No. So the Anti-Federalists became the Republicans, or I should say, because actually, so the Anti-Federalists were the cabal. What ended up happening was the seats changed. In other words, some of the Federalists were monarchical already, but most of those people that were ideologues that felt that, you know, we shouldn't have a monarchy, we shouldn't have all of these central powers, that we needed to maintain that, the purest of the Federalists that Madison was talking about, they ended up becoming Republicans in 1792, because this is when you know, Washington actually started seeing how parties were dividing. The Federalists actually subdivided and was actually, I'll just say, co-opted by the cabals and these people who wanted a big centralized government. Because they knew they couldn't get rid of the government now, so they might as well make it a, you know, more of a centralized power and collectivizing all of the power possible. So they slowly started doing that. You know, I mean, Hamilton was very clear in 1790 with the Assumption Act and then creating the bank in 1792. Mm-hmm. And that's what really, you know, when Madison found out what Hamilton was really up to, that's when they created, him and Jefferson created the Republican Party. It was not the Democratic Republicans. It was the Republican Party. And we'll get to that in the next document. But what he's basically pointing out was there was this schism. There was this desire of moving down this different path. And so let's pick it up from there, though.
Okay, so the last word was inspired, right?
Well, the predilections. The last word was the monarchical or aristocratical predilections. So go ahead.
Okay, let me...
So it's the next paragraph. This view of the crisis.
Oh, okay. This view of the crisis made it natural for many in the convention to lean more than was perhaps in strictness warranted by a proper distinction between causes temporary, as some of them doubtless were, and causes permanently inherent in popular frames of government. It is true also, as has been sometimes suggested, that in the course of discussions in the convention, where so much depended on compromise, the patrons of different opinions often set out on negotiating grounds more remote from each other than the real opinions of either were from the point at which they finally met.
Right. So that's what he's saying it's just typical. Like everybody wants the world and they end up settling for a small plot of land.
Correct.
Okay.
That's what I was going to say.
Right.
All right. For myself, having from the first moment of maturing a political opinion down to the present one, never ceased to be a votary of the principle of self-government. Okay, I was among those most anxious to rescue it from the danger which seemed to threaten it, and with that view was willing to give to a government resting on that foundation as much energy as it would ensure the requisite stability and efficacy. It is possible that in some instances this consideration may have been allowed a weight greater than subsequent reflection within the convention or the actual operation of the government would sanction. It may be remarked also that it sometimes happened that opinions as to a particular modification or a particular power of the government had a conditional reference to others, which combined therewith would vary the character of the whole. GR, that's a mouthful. Maybe you can summarize that.
Okay, so he's basically talking about, you know, the struggles that they had in this convention as they kept on working more and more towards a limited government that the, you know, that the states would have all the power, that the federal government was only to be given. So they were constantly moved by the body. Now, there was a point in time during the convention, the Constitutional Convention, when Hamilton had to go to New York, and I believe this was in July. And Madison writes in his notes, he writes this speech that Hamilton basically gave to the body before he stormed out. He was very dissatisfied with the direction that this was going. And he basically said, you know, even though he's on board with, you know, completing the Constitution, he's poking everybody in the eye, telling them that, oh, by the way, we need to have a permanent president. He was bearing his soul for the desire of having a more powerful monarchical government than Britain.
Wow. And Madison managed to get to document that.
Madison documented that, where he actually scoffed off. And so bottom line, when it came time to sign the Constitution, Hamilton signed it, and he became the proponent for its ratification. And as soon as he was seated as the Secretary of the Treasury and created the Secretary of State's job, you know, he empowered himself with everything. Okay. I mean, when you look at what this man did, he did everything he could to start creating implied powers and moving this government towards a far more powerful government than what was created.
Right.
Creating a bank and all of these different, his ambitions were greater than him. And he got to a point where he finally corrupted the government whole by the judicial authority. Because at the end of Adams, and so this, see, Hamilton wasn't done, but God basically said, or our creator, it's better to, I don't like saying God, forgive me. Mm-hmm. So our creator said that he was, and which is why Hamilton really never got back into truly mingling in government after the 1800 election, because he was killed. He was killed by Aaron Burr. in a duel. Mm-hmm. And but what he did, the damage was that significant because he got Marshall in as the Chief Justice, and Marshall was his protege. These guys worked together in the Revolutionary War. And there's a book out there by Kirk. I forget his full name. But it's from Burke to Eliot, The Conservative Thought from Burke to Eliot. And he kind of talks about, and he brings up in his book, how Hamilton had this protege, John Marshall, who basically he instilled, you know, what we had to do as the government started growing, and he was creating this terrible wake that caused the resolutions and everything else, which forced Hamilton and Jefferson to basically take a stand and go, we did not create an unlimited government. I mean, as he stated this so eloquently in the Kentucky resolutions, he literally started pointing out that this government had gone well beyond, as they started seeing, its avarice, its lust for power. And so as they unseated Adams, Hamilton's last ditch, and he, I mean, this guy was a strategist, and he was thinking two or three moves ahead of everybody. And so he had a list of judges, and he gave this list of judges, and these were all big government monarchical ideologues that went into these courts to aggrandize more power to the central government or the federal government.
Wow. Isn't that interesting?
And so, and I point this out in some of my writings, that when you start looking at how these other justices were appointed, the majority of them had a leaning towards slavery. Taney was not a part of those midnight judges. Marshall was, but Taney came in later. And look at who, I forget who it was that appointed Taney to be the Chief Justice. I think that probably fell upon Jackson. And Jackson, you got to remember, Jackson was a part of the Democratic Party that was actually trying to stifle any resistance or the abolitionist, you know, voice and everything else, because they actually put a gag order and no longer accepted First Amendment petitions regarding slavery.
Interesting.
And so this, at least in the Senate, and it's those ideas started growing. But when we look at how the justices were being selected, these justices were being selected that were harmonious with the agenda that America needed to move forward. And I have to, you know, create the connection here that clearly by this point in time, because in 1812, the 13th Amendment was created, where we actually started seeing in the legal side this desire to create these types of laws that weren't bound by the Constitution. In other words, the Bar Association, the British Accredited Registry, was already moving lawyers to start, because they were educating them. Most of these people, you know, you got to remember that our education system was still based on, and our educators, we didn't change our educators out. They were still people that were teaching the principles of the monarchy in law and all of these other forms, right?
Right. Okay.
And this is why I say, you know, I make the comment that we should have purged, you know, Blackstone's commentaries. We actually should have purged our education system as well. And actually started teaching these principles that were developed. But instead, they became this mystery that, oh, you know, they're glorious. We don't understand them. And so as people started interpreting them, they interpreted them, their interpretations became logical deductions to move towards a democracy and then eventually towards, because look at what happened to Israel. Israel had the, you know, the rule of judges. And slowly but surely over 400 years, as the world became monarchical, well, Israel became jealous and said, we have to have a monarch. And they put away this brilliant design of a government towards this monarchy.
So, okay, so here's what happened. We created this brilliant form of government, but we'd never done this before. So we didn't have the foresight to know that we needed to sweep clean.
Absolutely. Absolutely. These men, you know, these men aren't at fault because at that point in time, things, you know, they weren't driving close to the, I mean, they were driving away from the cliff thinking that they were doing, but, you know, they didn't realize that there were these turns that were leading us back.
Right.
Right. And they were little turns. Yeah. They were just a partial turn, right? You know, like just one mirror. You know, the car still seems like it's going in the same direction, but just a mirror is shifted. And, you know, little bit more and more, the car finally gets turned around.
Okay. And so there's all these old forces that are pushing. And Madison is recognizing this.
Right.
He's expressing this.
Right.
But,
and so, you know, but here's this next paragraph, this short paragraph,
okay,
is where it all comes to light, because, you know, he's talking about these views, you know, and what we thought, and, you know, that it didn't matter what we thought, it didn't matter what Hamilton thought, and he points to, you know, your truth is already available to you, you have to go there to get it. Because you won't find it with me.
Right.
Now, go ahead. But
whatever might have been the opinions entertained in forming the Constitution, it was the duty of all to support it in its true meaning as understood by the nation at the time of its ratification.
So what does he say right there? Folks, this is the whole thing. As he says this, but whatever might have been the opinions, he's given you these opinions and insights of the struggles and all of these things. But he says, but whatever might have been the opinions entertained in forming the Constitution, it was the duty of all to support it in its true meaning as understood by the nation at the time of its ratification. So what was that nation understanding? When you look at who ratified it, that was the states and how each state understood this Constitution. Because as we went through the ratification debates, did you find anything within the, you know, the proponent side of the ratifications, Madison or, you know, in Massachusetts, all of these guys that were supporting the Constitution, did any of them conflict with what the other states were saying?
No, amazingly, no.
There you go. So the whole point is that it was so succinctly supported, and even though the words were different, they all agreed that this was a limited government based on enumerated powers, which is why the argument of a Bill of Rights fell flat, and how the Constitution was ratified without a Bill of Rights. Now, it didn't mean that God didn't want, or our Creator didn't want us to have a Bill of Rights. It wasn't necessary. But the divine hand of providence realized that it would be necessary later, and if you didn't do it now, you wouldn't be able to get back to it.
Right.
Because he knew where this nation would slowly migrate away from these essences of what they were trying to protect, the rights of the people and so forth. So go ahead.
I never fail to be impressed by providence. But here's the rest of this paragraph. No one felt this obligation more than I have done, and there are few, perhaps, whose ultimate and deliberate opinions on the merits of the Constitution accord in a greater degree with that obligation.
There you go. I mean, it's just as humbly stated as possible that, you know, nobody felt this obligation probably greater than I. And he's absolutely correct, because when you look at his consistency as a man, as a president, and I can't say that Thomas Jefferson wasn't, but Madison was, he was just a humbled man. He came from what, you know, he considered himself, a humble home. It's Thomas Jefferson's father was, you know, a big name in the state when Thomas Jefferson was just a kid. His father was going out and doing surveys, you know, throughout the territories and so forth. And I think in, you know, Dumas Malone's book, he kind of talks about Jefferson kind of going out, you know, sometimes with his father when he was very young. Right. And so, wow, I mean, you know, here's a man that was really, he made a name for himself in the state. And then Thomas Jefferson, because his father was so affluent, you know, Thomas Jefferson had the best education. And with that best education, he became an affluent lawyer. And so the rest is history, folks. But James Madison really came from humble beginnings. It's not like, you know, his father was, you know, this really well-known name. And, you know, when he went to school, he went to Princeton. He had to go to a less, you know, a lower costly school because in, you know, Virginia and or up in Harvard and places like that, it was just more expensive. So anyway, let's go and go to kind of close this out here.
All right. So here we go. The departures from the true and fair construction of the instrument have always given me pain and always experienced my opposition when called for. The attempts in the outset of the government to defeat those safe, if not necessary, and those politic, if not obligatory, amendments introduced in conformity to the known desires of the body of the people and to the pledges of many, particularly myself, when vindicating and recommending the Constitution was an occurrence not a little ominous.
So right there, he kind of points out that the amendments that were driven by the people, by the body of the people, known desires of the body of the people. And so we saw the Bill of Rights, those 12 amendments that were submitted. And then we saw the 11th Amendment, the 12th Amendment, or I should say what we call the 11th and 13th, but the 11th Amendment, and then the 12th Amendment over the Electoral College. And then the only other amendment that was created was the one that basically vanquished or made it impossible for lawyers to become public servants. And so that, you know, because where did that desire come from? I don't know where the 13th Amendment was actually drafted. I've not ever really done all of the research on it, but I'm going to guess it probably did come from the states. Anyway.
Okay.
My apologies.
And it was soon followed by indications of political tenets and by rules, or rather the abandonment of all rules of expounding it, which were capable of transforming it into something very different from its legitimate character as the offspring of the national will. I wish I could say the constructive innovations had altogether ceased.
Right, because they haven't. These constructive alterations just occurred with Monroe dictating slavery or allowing Congress to dictate slavery upon all states that joined the Union that had a, you know, that were south of a specific latitude on the earth.
And that started with the Monroe Doctrine, and not the Monroe Doctrine, with the Missouri Compromise.
That's correct. And there were these other constructions, but anyway, he basically said that I wish I could say that constructive innovations had altogether ceased, but he can't.
Right. That wasn't a positive. These constructive innovations he didn't see as a positive.
Correct.
Okay. Whether the Constitution, as it has divided the powers of government between the states in their separate and in their united capacity, tends to an oppressive aggrandizement of the general government or to an anarchical independence of the state governments is a problem which time alone can absolutely determine. It is much to be wished that the division as it exists, or as it may be made with the regular sanction of the people, may effectually guard against both extremes. For it cannot be doubted that an accumulation of all power in the general government would as naturally lead to a dangerous accumulation in the executive hands as that the resumption of all power by the several states would end in the calamities incident to contiguous and rival sovereigns. to say nothing of its effect in lessening the security for sound principles of administration within each of them.
Okay.
Okay.
Does that all make sense? Because he's really kind of talking about how, you know, it we could go down this path of continuing. Or, you know, maybe the states themselves might actually prove an effectual guard against both extremes. Mm-hmm. For it can not be doubted that an accumulation of all power in the general government would as naturally lead to a dangerous accumulation in the executive hands. So he's basically saying that the more we give they assume, unconstitutionally assume power, it lends to create more of a monarch.
Right. Okay.
So there you go.
I'll go on. Okay?
Uh-huh. Go ahead.
There have been epochs when the general government was evidently drawing a disproportion of power into its vortex. There have been others when states threatened to do the same. At the present moment, it would seem that both are aiming at encroachments each on the other. One thing, however, is certain, that in the present condition and temper of the community, the general government cannot long succeed in encroachments contravening the will of a majority of the states and of the people. Its responsibility to these would, as was proved in a conspicuous occasion, quickly arrest its career. If at this time the powers of the general government be carried to unconstitutional lengths, it will be the result of a majority of the states and people actuating by some impetuous feeling or some real or supposed interest overruling the minority, and not of successful attempts by the general government to overpower both.
Okay, so...
Again, that's a mouthful.
It is, okay? But... You know, all of this is just, you know, his wisdom that he's basically kind of saying here, you know, here are where the dangers lie. And this is, you know, what you can expect if you go this way. And this is, you know, why this is so important that we kind of keep this constraint. Its responsibility to these would, as proved on a conspicuous occasion, quickly arrest its career. He's in a way, he's kind of talking about what ended up happening before when they went down this path, because they actually, you know, they corrected the problem when Jefferson and Madison stood up and got the got the Republic to stand up. And so we still have, you know, a couple paragraphs to do, and we've got less than a minute, half a minute. So I appreciate it. So tomorrow I'm going to actually air some questions, because I'm going to kind of leap forward, and we're going to air some questions that I got, and I do it an interview, or I say a mutual interview with Angeline, what we had her on before. And so what we want to do is we'll be back on Monday to finish this and then to dive into the notes on nullification.
Okay.
So thank you so much, Paul, for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me.
It's always a pleasure. And so, folks, as we conclude today, hopefully you're starting to see, and I will emphasize this on Monday as we bring this back, how Madison quickly and very pointedly pointed to the contract law, that it only mattered what the states understood the Constitution to be. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution donations page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty